I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. This is what Ron Rosenbaum's edgy enthusiasms sound like.
Oh, life is bigger. It's bigger than you, and you are not me.
Jock Strap. Hey, guys, I'm looking for a Jock Strap.
But what it holds for her, she hasn't yet. Yes, she needs wide open spaces.
Sweet Jane. Sweet, sweet Jane.
What else did the Marshall's wife put forth?
Form-fitting Western dress, nice bustier.
So what have you been doing all night?
Cleaning my gun, yeah.
Nate signal.
You still think he shot Uriah Baker?
I'm sure of it.
They're not that good at sneaking up.
Well, sneaking up had just been invented.
He's got a beautiful backswing.
Dad! Oh, he got all of that one. He's got to be pleased with that. The crowd is just on his feet here.
But let me get to the point. Let's roll another joint. Turn the radio loud. I'm too alone to be proud. You don't know how it feels. You don't know.
R.E.M., The Simpsons, The Dixie Chicks, The Cowboy Junkies, Mystery Science Theater 3000, Brahms, Bill Murray, and Tom Petty. They're all edgy. So are Keats, Trollope. Conspiracy theories about the JFK assassination, John Gotti's lawyer, Graham Greene, and Bob Dylan. Our guest Ron Rosenbaum has been writing about his pet obsessions, his peculiar curiosities, for years now. His column in the New York Observer is part literary criticism, part cultural eclecticism, it's part pop culture, it's part old-fashioned advocacy. Ron Rosenbaum got the novels of Charles Portis back into print. He saved the TV satire show Mystery Science Theater 3000, and he convinced the new owner of the Chrysler Building to keep its pretty lights on all night long. Alas, he did not manage to save his favorite bookstore in Manhattan from the clutches of real estate speculators. Ron Rosenbaum says he learned an important lesson from the Survivor series on CBS this summer, the importance of making alliances. So he is looking for like-minded allies to join his edgy alliance. Connection listeners, are you edgy? Are you enthusiastic? About what? Do you have your own alliance of shared enthusiasms, and what are they? 1-800-423-8255 makes the Edgy Enthusiasm Connection with Ron Rosenbaum. Our phone is 1-800-423-TALK, or you can post your list of edgy enthusiasms on our website at theconnection.org. Ron Rosenbaum's new book of collected columns is called The Secret Parts of Fortune. Ron Rosenbaum, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
We want to volunteer for the Alliance.
That's great.
We saw the application coupon in the New York Observer and said, that's for us. We also think we might improve it a little bit, especially musically. There's not much jazz there, not much African-American music.
Well, there's Sam Cooke, there's Smokey Robinson, there's the Shirelles, you know. I guess I'm more...
I want Billy Eckstine in there. I want Earl Hines in there. I want all of Pittsburgh.
Well,
Earl Garner, Ahmad Jamal.
I'm inviting people to make suggestions for future columns, I hope that they will. That's one of the purposes of the Alliance. One of the purposes of the Alliance, I have this idea, arise, ye prisoners of the peg. So much cultural writing in America is determined by the publicity industrial complex. Hmm. What's next off the press? What movie is about to arrive in theaters? No one spends any time delving deeper into all the great things that have been published 3 years ago, 30 years ago, 300 years ago. And that's one of the purposes of my column, is to sort of spend time with some of the great literature, the great music, the great films, the great theater that are already there but are sort of tossed in the dustbin by the onrushing publicity machine.
You know, we've all been thinking about our own edgy enthusiasm since we decided we wanted to do this program, but with my own, but again with yours, I wonder, what is the thread here? What is the connection in your enthusiasms, do you think? Or is it just that you like them?
Well, one of the threads, I guess, is close reading and the search for mysteries beneath the surface of familiar works, or apparently familiar works.
Close reading is kind of code. Decode it. What do you mean by close reading?
Well, you know, so much of writing about literature in the academy, in colleges and universities these days, is about theory. When I was at Yale, people still were encouraged to get into the text, into the texture of literature, to pay attention to the words, to the imagery. My hero is William Empson, the author of Seven Types of Ambiguity, someone who searches for
the new ambiguity. Criticism, so-called, yeah.
Yeah, the new critics. And close reading is coming back, actually. I recently wrote a piece for the Times Book Review about how attending a Shakespeare scholars conference, in which it seemed like at last close reading is coming back, and people have exhausted themselves on theory, and theory is basically, you know, ignoring the text and telling the reader that you know, the critic is more important.
Close reading, of course, requires writers that can be read closely. I want to ask about one of your enthusiasms that I don't know anything about at all. That's the writer Charles Portis. Who he? And why do you say nobody should leave the planet without reading Dog of the South?
Portis is this wonderful novelist who is almost a Salinger-like recluse. He lives down in Arkansas, and definitely don't die before you read Dog of the South. It's a classic American novel. It's funny, it's poignant, it's beautiful. And he's written a series of novels that were out of print for a long time. And unfortunately, his reputation among literary types is not as high as it is, because I feel they blame him for the one novel he did that was popular, a novel called True Grit. And because True Grit was popular, and because John Wayne starred in the movie, people don't, you know, the serious literateurs of the world dismiss him. But in fact, I think he's one of the most brilliant American writers, and he's one who will last. And I guarantee, if you read The Dog of the South, you will thank me for the experience.
I like the promise. I thank you in advance. I will read it. It's a little bit, you talk about Charles Portis a little bit the way you write about Murray Kempton, the late great. There were large parts of his collection, America Comes of Middle Age, that I thought I memorized in the 50s and 60s. Why Murray Kempton?
My life was changed by Murray Kempton. When I was a bored student in high school, I was taking remedial driver's ed, I think, and I was wandering around the school library, embittered already, and I came upon Murray Kempton's memoir, Part of Our Time, which I think is the one American political memoir that can stand with George Orwell. And it's a memoir of Kempton's experience as a communist in the 30s, and then abandoning the Communist Party, and then his portraits of some of the people he fought on the barricades with, some who stayed with the party, some who abandoned it, some who were victims of McCarthyism. But what Kempton told me, he's the most brilliant stylist and also a master of ambiguity, contradiction, paradox, irony. I learned everything I ever could possibly hope to learn about writing about politics and writing about history, intellectual history, from Murray Kempton. And
in those
again,
very days when you were reading him in high school, I was waiting outside Liggett's in New Haven for the New York Post to be delivered. I think it was Tuesdays and Thursdays. My friend Bill Reel and I used to wait, and we would go in and order up a cup of coffee and read Murray Kempton together. It was a ritual. He was a close reader of the world, really. I mean, he held up the text of our lives in the 60s and read them carefully.
You know, he was always surprising. He was absolutely thrilling to pick up his column because you would look at all these familiar characters, Jimmy Hoffa, Harry Truman, Joe McCarthy, Richard Nixon. And the great thing about Murray Kempton is he believed in what he called losing side consciousness. He felt that the great truths of history and human nature were not found among the winners, but in the loser's locker room. You know, and one of his classic columns was about being in the loser's locker room when the Dodgers lost to the Giants and that Bobby Thompson home run. He always felt that, you know, that you learn more about human nature if you spend time with the beautiful losers.
The phone is 1-800-423-8255. The question, Connection listeners, is what do you feel edgy about? And are you ready to join the Ron Rosenbaum Edgy Enthusiast Alliance? 1-800-423-TALK or online at theconnection.org. We want to put some additions onto his list. The list, though, I must say, is enormously interesting. You're a Kim Philby conspiracy buff. You're a JFK assassination buff. You're a lot of this is Yale. I mean, there's this sort of deep skull and bones thing, which George W. Bush is going to refresh for you, that he's going to keep that whole thing alive. There's also, you did that, did you break the story about the Yale posture pictures, the nude photographs of every Yale freshman since
this
time
was
began?
One of my great investigative triumphs. You know, it's a little known fact that George W. Bush, George Bush Sr., you, me, generations of Yale, Harvard, every Ivy League, women's colleges, Hillary Clinton, Diane Sawyer, there was this strange ritual known as the posture photo. And when you were a freshman, you had to go to the gym, take off your clothes. They attached steel pins to your back and took nude pictures of you from three angles. And people just sort of accepted it. Well, I discovered that, in fact, the origin of this was a strange pseudoscientist named W.H. Sheldon, who felt that all of human nature could be compressed into a three-digit number comprised of postural ratios. And he talked all these elite institutions into turning over their student bodies, literally, to him. And for years, no one knew what became of the photos. And I actually tracked them down and found tens of thousands of them stuck in this obscure anthropological archive in the back room of the Smithsonian. And when I published the story in the New York Times Magazine, it caused some consternation among several generations of Ivy League graduates who were unaware that these nude photos were circulating and could be, you know, gazed at by researchers.
I'm wondering, and maybe you should introduce yourself, I mean, who is Ron Rosenbaum, and how did you decide you were qualified to be Ron Rosenbaum? There's practically nobody like you in journalism. You remind me sometimes of the late Esquire and Boston newspaper columnist George Frazier, who had similar obsessions. I mean, he was interested in skull and bones. He was also interested in Brooks Brothers collars and why no real gentleman should ever have a shirt pocket. He used to cut them off with a razor blade, and I still do just because of him. He wrote about Duende and all sorts of similar obsessions. But I guess it's the question is sort of, who are you and how did you get to be Ron Rosenbaum?
It's a good question. I ask myself that sometimes. I was a suburban kid, you know, who grew up on pop culture and rock and roll and went to Yale and read Murray Kempton and studied close reading.
With Harold
and
Bloom, no?
I did take Bloom's course, although he wasn't my favorite, actually. I was deeply involved with the metaphysical poets, the pre-17th century poetry. And then when I fled academia because I couldn't stand the sherry parties and I wanted to sort of solve mysteries and have adventures, the Hardy Boys were actually a real influence on me. I read them as a bored suburban child. But I found that as an investigative reporter, I could bring to bear upon the kinds of texts you find, like autopsy reports, mob wiretaps, trial transcripts, those things, the kind of techniques of close reading that I had previously applied to the metaphysical poets. And so maybe that's my sort of you know, I didn't go to journalism school, but I did study metaphysical poetry, and somehow that lens and Murray Kempton and people like that.
You write wonderfully about how Charles Dickens's Dombey and Son rocked your world, but also Borges, J.D. Salinger, things of that sort.
You know, I believe I'm the first to disclose the meaning of the sound of one hand clapping, the famous line that is the epigraph to J.D. Salinger's short story collection, Nine Stories, in which he asks, we know the sound of two hands clapping. What is the sound of one hand clapping? Well, in fact, the sound of one hand clapping, monks in Zen monasteries are taught this, and everyone out there can follow me and do it, is you bring your hand up from your side to the position it would hold if you were to clap with two hands, only you have one hand there, and you bring it towards where the other hand would meet it, except there's no other hand there, and then you tune into the silence that is found in the absence of the other hand. And in fact, if you read the very first short story in J.D. Salinger's Nine Stories, A Perfect Day for Banana Fish, you will find that gesture of one hand clapping secretly embedded there, but evident to the close reader. You will find it when Seymour Glass's wife, Muriel, who is a sort of, she's portrayed as a kind of vulgar, materialistic woman. She's drying the hands of her nails, and it describes her in that story waving her hand back and forth to dry her nails, in effect making the sound of one hand clapping. And it's a beautiful Salinger-esque moment, because he's embedded in the apparent vulgar ritual of the material world this spiritual gesture.
What position do you take on the memoirs by Joyce Maynard, and now of J.D. Salinger's daughter, whom we're going to interview tomorrow?
Well, you know, there's a line from Yeats, after such knowledge, what forgiveness? You know, and I'm fascinated by Salinger, and so I certainly, you know, want to know, in a way, what makes him tick. But on the other hand, I feel bad that this 81-year-old man up in New Hampshire who is...
You went and stood in his driveway yourself. I mean,
that's right. I mean, I was so fascinated by him. The way I construe Salinger's silence, you know, a lot of people think of Salinger's silence as just sort of some nutty eccentricity or some, you know, crazy withdrawal from the world because he can't handle it. I see Salinger's silence in some way as his most enduring work of art. He's a conscientious objector, in a way, to the publicity industrial complex. His silence, cumulatively, in a way, is some poses, some alternative to the mad world of celebrity culture. And I went up to his driveway, and there's a story in my book about this journey I took to sort of pay tribute to Salinger's wall of silence, to stand in his driveway and sort of see what it felt like to be there. And on the other hand, I was really conflicted, and I described the conflicts in my story about doing that, because in the end, you know, in an attempt to pay tribute to his silence, do you sort of threaten it? And so I'm standing there on his driveway making the sound of one hand clapping, and a car starts hurtling down the driveway, and I can't tell whether it's Salinger or his wife at the wheel, but I had a sense that this was I say in the story, if you ever felt that a car could be said to be angry. It was an angry car driving off, spattering me with mud. And so I tried in the story to capture the kind of conflict we feel about a writer like Salinger, who, you know, we admire him for his silence, and yet, you know, we still want to hear, we want to know about him.
We want to test
stop.
It.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Edgy Alliance connection with our guest, Ron Rosenbaum. He's a man of many passions. A lot of them, they're readers' passions, including for the work of Wilkie Collins, for example. You mentioned The Woman in White. Nicholson Baker, or the kind of academic gossip sheet, Lingua Franca. The Roman philosopher Lucretius, the work of Raymond Chandler, but also John Gotti's lawyer. What is so special about John Gotti's lawyer?
Well, you know, I wrote a column because I felt that the feds really were piling on when they deprived John Gotti of Bruce Cutler, who was his lawyer, in that final trial that sent him into the hole forever. Because, you know, I'm no, you know, admirer of Gotti's great humanitarian works, but I think a guy deserves the best kind of representation. And I got to know Bruce Cutler, and I'd done a story, and I'd hung out with him, and I, you know, and he's a fierce courtroom advocate. You know, when he cross-examines a snitch, he doesn't crucify them, because they say he brucifies them, and he's brilliant. And the feds trumped up this, I think, really phony rationale to say that, well, Bruce Cutler was part of the Gotti family, part of the ongoing conspiracy. Therefore, he couldn't, he shouldn't have been allowed to represent him. But, and in fact, Gotti got a, you know, some terrible, you know, lawyer who, you know, or anyway, it was a certainly ineffective or failed defense. And I just feel like, you know, the feds should not be able to deprive you of the best representation.
Fair enough. Ron Rosenbaum is our guest. Connection listeners, we want to sweeten and extend or broaden or endorse his edgy alliance. 1-800-423-TALK is the phone. Andy is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Andy.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
This is Andy
yes.
Rangel.
Ah, the pianist. One of my edgy enthusiasms.
First of all, well, Ron's list is wonderful and appealing to me. I want to thank you for your, Chris, for your comment right at the outset about the lack of your perception that there was a lack of some edgy jazz on this list. I think that was a pertinent observation.
And Andy, so you know, Ron is a straight pianist, a Bach guy.
Well, hey, well, I have my very edgy qualities, even
in... You have an edgy brother in jazz, too.
So two of them, in fact.
Ah.
My addition, my little personal additions to this list, just right off the cuff, three or four writers. One musician who is completely underrated, the composer, the Danish composer, Carl Nielsen, who is an astonishing, personal, arresting, original, and edgy composer of the first stripe, and whose Sixth Symphony is one of the great, great, underrated...
Andy Rangel, I have to interrupt you just to tell folks that you're listening to The Connection. Andrew Rangel, carry on.
Okay.
Edgily.
Nielsen and his Sixth Symphony. Among writers, quickly, the somewhat known writers, Flann O'Brien, who also was a journalist and an edgy one at that,
right.
Marvelous novel.
I have the Dalkey Archive,
Swim Two Birds
actually.
And all that?
Right, At Swim Two Birds. The Third Policeman, his great masterpiece. The stories of Mavis Gallant. Particularly the stories of a completely forgotten and English master. I don't know if you know the one of my absolute favorites, A.E. Coppard, C-O-P-P-A-R-D,
no.
One of the absolute masters of the short story.
Hmm.
Charles Reade, the Victorian novelist, a contemporary of Dickens, and who I often find even more enjoyable than Dickens. And one last point having to do with an author who's going to make the rounds soon again. That's Kazuo Ishiguro.
Oh, we can't wait.
And the point with him for me is that he was very well known because of his because of The Remains of the Day, which made it into the movies. And his subsequent novel, a much more labyrinthine novel, The Unconsoled, was, I think, passed over for lack of a kind an appreciative reading, and to me it is a towering masterpiece. But
we're with you, Andy, and we didn't pass it over. We had a wonderful hour with him, and we look forward to it on his on his new novel, too. That's a wonderful list. Back to you, Ron Rosenbaum. You got to swear Andy into the alliance.
Well, that's exactly the kind of call and the kind of suggestions I was hoping for when I decided to call for this edgy alliance. And by the way, if you would like to join and or make suggestions, please write me at Box 105, 577 Second Avenue, New York, New York, 10016. I would love to have more suggestions and more people like this as part of this.
Say it one more time.
Sure. It's the Edgy Alliance, Box 105, 577 Second Avenue, New York, New York, 10016. And if you send me your suggestions and your address, I'll send you back a membership card I'm having printed up. And I sort of see this alliance as a kind of mobile cultural strike force, that suggestions come in, columns get written, we can support each other's edgy enthusiasms.
Yeah, you with this badge of membership in the Edgy Alliance, you are certifiably cool.
I don't know about cool, but and also I want to say that I don't think of edgy as in the sense of cutting edge, in that, you know, deplorable new sense. I think of edgy as sort of like irritable, more ill at ease, or somewhat, you know, someone who's obsessive.
We're talking about the Edgy Alliance with our guest, Ron Rosenbaum. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. What are your own edgy enthusiasms? This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Ledden. This is the Edgy Enthusiasm Connection.
Don't you know? That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang. All day long they're saying.
Sam Cooke is one of Ron Rosenbaum's edgy enthusiasms. So is the poetry of George Herbert. The novels of Vladimir Nabokov, especially Pale Fire. Doo-wop music. 1-800-423-8255 makes the edgy enthusiasm connection. Share your own and join the alliance if you like. 1-800-423-TALK, or you can join us online at theconnection.org. Sue is on the line.
Yes, hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on today. It's a great show.
Thank you, Sue.
I have a couple of additions, and I would very much also like to agree with what was said earlier about the fact that there are some tremendous pieces of artwork and even commercial TV that's being produced out there that loses out because it's not publicized well to the vast majority of people. One thing that comes to mind along those lines is Freaks and Geeks, which was a terrific television show, well-written, beautifully performed, that I think was handled very poorly by NBC, was bounced around repeatedly. Mystery Science Theater 3000 is a favorite of mine, and they've certainly suffered terribly trying to find the right format.
For those of us who don't watch Mystery Science Theater or much TV, introduce us, Sue.
Well, I would probably leave that to the wonderful articulation of your guest. But in a nutshell, it's a wonderful show that spoofs really awful movies by drawing up a variety of cultural references that range from the ridiculous to the sublime, that are voiced by a fellow and two robots who are sitting in a theater watching the movie on the screen in front of them.
That's beautiful.
How could you improve on that?
Said it better, yes. And it's still, you could still see reruns at Saturday morning on the Sci-Fi Channel, 9 to 11.
Yeah, thanks to you.
Really, yeah, exactly. I kept it on for about 3 years more than after it was about to be killed. But it has officially ended its its first-run career, but it still can be seen in reruns.
Sue, did you want to list some others?
Yes, in conjunction with that, there are a number of projects that the folks who wrote that show have taken on, one of which is a book that was recently published by Mike Nelson, who was the head writer for the show and one of the stars. He was the guy in the theater with the two robots. He wrote a book called Mike Nelson's Movie Mega Cheese, which is a review of movies, bad movies, and also bad television, which is just hilarious. I think it was a compendium of columns that originally ran in Home Theater Magazine. That's a terrific source. And Joel Hodson, who was one of the original creators of the show, has done some very innovative things on TV, including a program, off-the-wall experimental show called The TV Wheel, that was shown only once or twice on cable.
So do you want to dissent from Ron Rosenbaum's list or add significantly to it?
Well, I'm adding those two because people might think Mystery Science Theater 3000 and not think about the individuals who have sprung out of that.
Okay.
One other thing I would like to add that is perhaps not on his list is a terrific band, also very articulate, very intelligent, brilliant musicians called They Might Be Giants. It's a New York-based band.
Sue, thank you.
I love them.
All right. I want more music on this list. 1-800-423-8255. Jeremy is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome,
Chris.
Jeremy.
Chris, good morning. Great show. Great combination of shows. I don't have too many to add, but I did hear in your promo that your guest has some thoughts on Dylan, and I think that that's someone who has always been edgy. Is edgy now. I think people are trying to turn him into the late Elvis or something, and he's not. And I'd be curious to hear some of your guest thoughts on that. Two people I would like to add.
Okay.
One saxophone player, Ike Quebec, from the 50s.
Yep.
Fascinating character, both in ballads and some edgy jazz. And also Lucinda Williams, who is someone who people don't know really what to do with. And any thoughts on those?
What should we do with Lucinda?
Well, it's very interesting because there was a guy in Slate magazine, Mickey Kouse, who actually seemed to want to fix me up with Lucinda Williams. He had something called the Yentomatic, and he said that he thought somehow my enthusiasms and her might match. In my dreams, of course, but I'm glad your caller mentioned Dylan, because I've been a Dylan enthusiast since I think it was my high school graduation party. I heard Like a Rolling Stone, and it was like I was struck by lightning, and I actually interviewed Dylan. I spent 3 or 4 days interviewing him for Playboy in the late 70s and watching Ronaldo and Clara, his 4.5-hour movie, which has some of the best Dylan music ever. And also, I just recently attended a lecture by another guy on my list, Christopher Ricks, the brilliant literary critic who is also a Dylan fan and recently lectured about Dylan. So I agree with your caller that it's somehow I don't think we've even begun to scratch the surface of how great Dylan is, perhaps because he's done so much. If you'd done 3 or 4 of his songs, we'd be, you know, spending all our time slapping our foreheads over how great they are. But he's done so much, it's almost too much to cope with.
Jeremy, is that enough of the Dylan take?
Well, Chris, you know, that's the thing. I mean, what your guest says is so true. If Dylan had died, for instance, in his famous motorcycle accident, we would have been amazed, and that would have been enough. Mm. It's almost... he's one of those artists, one of those, whether he was a writer or a filmmaker, who people feel has stayed beyond his time. But if you're still there, it still is his time. It's, you know, he's still going on. And I wonder, just briefly, what your guest thoughts on the recent Dylan music is, and what's his role now, if he has one, or is he just in sort of a traveling vaudevillian Vegas Dylan show? I mean, what's going on with Dylan now? Is he still edgy?
Well, I mean, there are two aspects of Dylan now. There's this relentless touring he does in which he reinvents his songs. I mean, hearing him live is quite exciting. There was a period, I think, when Dylan was touring and he was playing his music where he would deliberately trash his own songs, play them in a squeaky or sing them in a kind of squeaky helium voice or distort them because he was, in some way, he wanted to trash them so that when we heard them again, they could be fresh again. And he's doing that now. They're fresh again. And and he's playing his, you know, when you hear him now, he just is reinventing them beautifully. And he's also writing brilliantly. I mean, I forget the title of his most recent song, his most recent album, but I called it the Death Album. You know, there's a brilliant meditations about death in his music recently. And I wrote about the time when he had that heart scare, and you know, it seemed to have in some way invigorated his work by causing him to think about the ends of things in a way.
Jeremy, thanks for getting Dylan started. 1-800-423-8255. The edgy enthusiasms of you, the Connection listeners, and our guest, Ron Rosenbaum. Barry's calling from Mystic, Connecticut.
Hi, Chris.
I'd like to
mention and put forth the name of a movie director named Ken Loach. Have you heard of him?
Probably, but
okay. Well, he's
I recognize him as a distant stranger. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's too bad, because I think he's the greatest filmmaker right now.
Name a movie or two.
How about My Name is Joe, which is one of them that came up here to Mystic anyway, and in a small theater, Hidden Agenda. His great movie to me is Land and Freedom, about the Spanish Civil War, which could have been written by George Orwell. Riff Raff. Carla's Song, which is about Nicaragua and the problems that we had there. I should say, I think he is not known about, probably because he is a socialist, although he's not didactic at all. His movies are not commercial. It almost makes it impossible to look at a commercial film after looking at a Ken Loach film. They're so beautifully done, so well written, so well photographed.
Barry, this is very tempting. I'd love to see them. Ron, are you aware of Ken Loach?
I've seen Hidden Agenda and admired it. I thought it was a great movie. The others, I haven't, but I definitely will check them out now.
Talk about the movies on your own list, Ron.
Blade Runner is one. I think Blade Runner kind of grows in stature. I wrote a column about the debate over Blade Runner, because recently... There was a director's cut released, which eliminates Harrison Ford's Raymond Chandler-esque voiceover narrative. And it's one of the few cases in which I think actually the studio release is, to my mind, better than the director's cut. And I know this is heresy to say this, because it's sort of cult of the director's cut. But anyway, Blade Runner, you know, grows. It's not just a science fiction movie. It's a movie about what it means to be human. The Third Man. I recently wrote a column about The Third Man and the historical connection between The Third Man, which was written by Graham Greene, and I call it, so I still think it's like the greatest film noir of the past century, and the Kim Philby case, because Graham Greene was a friend of Kim Philby, and The Third Man is a film about friendship and betrayal, and in some way, Graham Greene, apparently, in recent biographies of Graham Greene, there are hints that Graham Greene knew Kim Philby was a Russian spy when Graham Greene was serving in British intelligence with Kim Philby. In fact, Graham Greene refused a promotion to be Philby's deputy because he may well have suspected it, but he did not betray Kim Philby. And the same relationship exists in the movie The Third Man between Harry Lime and his friend Holly Martins. And it's you know, sort of fabulously intertwined subtextual relationship between the spy of the century and one of the great, if not spy movies, but thrillers of the century, The Third Man.
I'm just one of those people who could never get the Kim Philby story straight. It's too complicated. Too many. Everybody in the world knew Kim Philby, and nobody has made it clear to me just exactly what that story was. Is there a way to learn the Kim Philby obsession in one volume?
I don't know if it's possible in one volume, but you could learn it in the story I have in my new book, The Secret Parts of Fortune, in which I think I go into the latest developments in the Kim Philby story. I mean, Philby was, he was known as the third man, but he was a double agent. He was a guy who came from the best British schools, Cambridge, and went into the British Secret Service after he'd been recruited by the Soviets. So he was a mole, as they say. And he rose very high in the British Secret Service, almost to becoming the head of MI6, James Bond's boss, in effect, all the while working for the Soviets. And Kim Philby is one of these little-known, behind-the-scenes people who shaped the secret history of the 20th century. Because at a certain point, when Kim Philby, at the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War, Kim Philby was in this amazing double-edged position. He was responsible for telling, in his official capacity, telling the West, telling the British government, what was going on in the Soviet Union, what was going on in the mind of Joseph Stalin. But he was also responsible, in his capacity as a Soviet mole, for telling Joseph Stalin what was going on in the West, what was going on in the mind of Churchill. He was in this unique position where he was could create the reality for both sides of the Cold War.
I start with your book. Great I'm not character. Sure I've got time in life to figure out Kim Philby, but we'll try. 1-800-423-TALK, the edgy enthusiasm connection with Ron Rosenbaum. Justin is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Justin.
Thank you. I heard you mention in the introduction about Trollope, and I'm currently reading Barchester Towers.
Oh, great. Start with the warden. Isn't it perfect?
Indeed. And I'm right in the middle of it, but it reminds me a whole lot of a movie, Strictly Ballroom. I don't know if that makes any sense. Australian movie probably about 10 years ago, and kind of the whole...
Great. But enormous, what's the connection? What's
enormous the drama around simply drama of manners, and it doesn't rely on sort of action and kind of drama in the small things. And Strictly Ballroom is all about enormous drama, kind of... innovating the dance steps in the ballroom dancing community in Australia, probably around Sydney, I can't really remember, and kind of how it creates shock and scandal simply to introduce a new dance step. And
do you get that edgy leap, Ron Rosenbaum, Trollope to Strictly Ballroom?
Yes, exactly. I see exactly what he's saying. It's sort of the, you know, Trollope was a great observer of the pettiness, the sublime pettiness of human nature. You know, Barchester Towers is this great novel about people in a frenzy over a promotion within a vicarage, you know, and I love Trollope. I think the Victorians in some way are neglected, that because again, like Dylan, they've done so much. I mean, Trollope did about 100 novels, all of them 500, 600, 700 pages. Wilkie Collins, dozens of these huge novels. And I definitely would recommend that people who haven't read The Woman in White dive into that novel. It's just a delirious madhouse of a novel. And while Trollope, I think, has sort of gotten his due lately, I think Wilkie Collins, Dickens' contemporary, Dickens' doppelganger in a way, is a novelist that you can
a lot of them at it too. So you could start. I recommend you start with The Moonstone, with Wilkie Collins, the first great detective novel, and a wonderful, wonderful epistolary. Story, a detective story told in letters.
Absolutely.
1-800-423-8255. Ron Rosenbaum is our guest. He's the edgy enthusiast of the New York Observer. He was the edgy enthusiast before that, a man of learning, curiosity, passion. 1-800-423-8255 joins the conversation with your own edgy enthusiasms. You are listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-8255. John is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, John.
Hi. I'd
Welcome.
Like to make a plug for an edgy architect.
Oh, good.
You probably haven't heard of him. He's actually, unfortunately, he's not with us anymore. His name is Douglas Darden. and he had a book of his works published. It was called Condemned Buildings.
Hmm.
Huh. Difficult book to find, but if you do, it's worth it. It's all sort of fantastic projects of his own making, if you will.
Did it get built or didn't, John?
I think nothing that he ever designed got built. He was more
That's
of an,
really edgy.
Yeah, exactly. He was more of an artist working in the medium of architecture, if you will.
Duly noted, Douglas Darden.
Douglas
Any others
Darden.
In the architecture bag?
Well, all the guys out there nowadays that are getting published are kind of fun to watch the development of. I mean, you know, Geary, obviously, and he's sort of brought everything to a new level, and Herzog and de Meuron, I think, are doing some really interesting stuff these days. But everyone's kind of getting edgy in the architecture world, I think. But this guy is a kind of a fantastic sort of find. If you can find a copy of the book anywhere, I definitely recommend it.
Excellent. John, thank you. Let's get edgy. 1-800-423-TALK. Felix is in a payphone.
Good morning.
Thanks.
Hi. Thank you for the program. I think your guest would find a great following in Russia. There's a lot of edgy writers and poets in Russian literature right now. There's a guy who writes one-line poems, and I'll try to translate one. Oh, how suddenly the couch has ended.
What's his name?
Vladimir Vishnevsky.
Oh, how suddenly the couch has ended. That is edgy. That's edgitudinous. Felix, you're great. Thank you.
Another musician on your list. Hello?
Yeah, please.
Yes.
Yes, a New York band called Voltaire, like the French philosopher. They have a wonderful, dark sense of humor and an excellent musicianship.
Hmm.
They have a violin, a cello, and a drum, and a guitar. And they have one lyric that goes something like this. You've said the snakes loose inside my belly. They done with my supper. They start on my endocrine lining. You say, please stop your whining.
That's edgy.
Felix, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Maureen is on the line.
Hi, I'm pulling over as I was instructed to do.
Good.
So you can hear me better. Can you hear me?
Perfectly.
Okay, I may have missed the very beginning of it, but I was kind of wondering where all the women were on the edgy list. And since I kind of consider myself a little edgy, I wanted to make sure that was put right. One person in music that strikes me as edgy, I was thinking about as I was driving, is Chrissy Hynde.
Hynde's on my list.
Oh,
I've done
she?
A column. But yeah,
oh, great.
Chrissy Hynde's on, yeah.
Oh, good. Okay, so I didn't know that.
I think
that.
She's a genius.
Then, up with the edgy chicks, Maureen, anymore.
And then I was thinking about from literature, I mean, sort of going way back and sort of unexpectedly, I would have thought, I think Jane Eyre, which is, I have to admit, is my favorite book. I thought she was kind of edgy, especially for her time. And actually, maybe it was the writer, Bronte, who was so edgy. But her character, you know, is not just one of those simpering women waiting for, you know, love to find her. I mean, she didn't make compromises, and she had plenty of attitude. She didn't stand for injustice, and I thought she was brave and true to herself right to the end. And
I do, too.
People, they thought she had attitude, and I kind of like that. And then I was thinking about Bella Abzug, you know, some of the people that have sort of faded maybe from recent memories. But I thought she was plenty edgy. And Ann Richards of Texas. And I was trying to think of others, but, you know, naturally, now that I'm on the phone, I'm kind of going blank. But I
That's
know
good. You scored with Charlotte Bronte. Maureen, thank you. I want to get one more edgy caller on here. David is on the line.
Yes, hello.
Welcome, David.
Hi, how are you? Great to hear your show again. I was home in Minnesota for a couple of weeks.
And oh, welcome back to civilization.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to tell you how much I've really enjoyed this show, and I just a couple of things that I just wanted to put out there. There's one. One is a short-lived television series called The Adventures of Pete and Pete. It's actually made for Nickelodeon. It was a children's show, and it's got a huge cult following.
Hmm.
It's just a fantastical show about normal neighborhood kids.
Name one more, David.
Okay.
We got to get our edgy way out of here.
Absolutely. It's the director, Hal Hartley. He's out there now.
Name a movie.
His most recent is called Henry Fool. I just thought I'd throw those out. Thanks.
Ron Rosenbaum, do you want to endorse that? You know Hal Hartley?
I'm not a big Hal Hartley fan. I'll mention a couple more women, though, on my list but for the other callers' benefit. Ricky Lee Jones is on my list.
Mm-hmm.
Ann Magnusson. In addition to Chrissy Hynde, we have the Dixie Chicks, Sandra Bernhardt, another favorite, Edith Wharton.
Oh, all time.
Roseanne Cash.
Gotta go. Ron Rosenbaum, you're wonderful. Readers, you can catch Ron Rosenbaum's edgy enthusiast column in the New York Observer. His new book is called The Secret Parts of Fortune, and you can continue the edgy enthusiast conversation on our website at theconnection.org. Ron Rosenbaum, thank you. We enjoy
Thanks,
your
Chris.
Work. I'm Christopher Great. Leiden. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.